listen to audio of today's show, get a podcast, you can go to democracynow.org. All transcripts of all shows are there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein. The screening is Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center. Gaining Ground is a film about growing food, empowering communities, and changing lives. It also addresses the negative impacts of industrial agriculture and genetically modified foods. It is an intimate view of rural and urban farmers embracing challenges. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center, Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 934 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
On March 17th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., from the grassroots, where we agitate for social change, with music and commentary, we will honor Her Majesty, the Queen of Soul. She plans on retiring this year, and her birthday is March 25th. So let us honor Her Majesty, the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, on Friday, March 17th, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, no charges will be filed in the shooting death last month of Jason Peterson.
A new report by the Congressional Budget Office finds that the number of Americans without health insurance will skyrocket if the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, is replaced with the proposed Republican alternative.
And the Scottish government today announced plans to hold another referendum on independence from the United Kingdom.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 13th, 2017. I'm Zella Zellis-Marchant.
And I'm Ken Jones. Portland police are investigating several instances of hate graffiti in the Richmond neighborhood over the weekend. Reports of swastikas spray-painted on homes, cars, fences, sidewalks, and trees in the area started coming in early Sunday morning. The reports were focused on Southeast 33rd Avenue between Division Street and Powell Boulevard. Neighborhood residents were able to quickly clean off the graffiti by Sunday afternoon. The timing of the incident coincides with the Jewish holiday of Purim, which began Saturday night. So far this year in Portland, there have been 156 threats to Jewish centers and synagogues, including Portland's Middleman Jewish Community Center just last week. If you were a victim of the hate graffiti or have any information relating to the case, you can call the Portland Police Bureau non-emergency line at 503-823-3333 or email the information to crimetips, all one word, crimetips, at portlandoregon.gov.
On Tuesday, February 20th, a homeless man suffering from schizophrenia was shot outside an insurance office on Southeast 82nd Avenue. 32-year-old Jason Peterson had recently moved out of his father's house and was planning to leave town for New Orleans, but ended up with his belongings on the doorstep of Golden Key Insurance. The owner of Golden Key, 47-year-old Charlie Nguyen Chan, removed Peterson's belongings. When he was confronted afterwards by Peterson, Chan shot him. Peterson was taken to the hospital where he died later that night. After the police completed their investigation, the matter went to a grand jury, which decided this morning to acquit Chan. He will face no charges for fatally shooting the mentally ill homeless man who had taken up residence on the stoop of his insurance building. Peterson had reportedly been in and out of jail and on and off his medication recently and threatened Chan and Chan's wife before the shooting. His death is a further eruption of recent tensions that have plagued the Lentz neighborhood since homeless people were swept from the Springwater Corridor last fall.
The last several years have seen a number of contentious local ballot measures in Oregon's rural counties around the use of pesticides and genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. Nearly all of these measures have inspired record-breaking campaign donations for county measures, with the against side often receiving prominent donations from agrochemical giants like Monsanto, Dow, and Cargill. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has this story on a measure in Lincoln County, Oregon, which hugs the coast west of Salem.
Last week, KBOO covered a ballot measure in Lincoln County, Oregon, that seeks to ban aerial pesticide spraying there. In that piece, we spoke to Rio Davidson, one of the organizers of the group that put Measure 21-177 on the May ballot. He explained what drove the members of the Lincoln County community to try to ban aerial pesticides.
There's been so many stories of people, either with birth defects, miscarriages, cancer clusters. I mean, the list goes on. And then, what's really shocking to us is that they're actually clear-cutting around our watershed. And so that was one of the main drivers of our group, is to protect our water. We feel like that's the most important thing that our community has. And unfortunately, mostly private timber holders, unfortunately out-of-state large corporations, mostly funded by Wall Street, they really have shown little respect to our watersheds. And so, that was really what drove us.
That was Rio Davidson of the group Lincoln County Community Rights. Their name points to one of their main partners, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, a Pennsylvania-based advocacy group that helps local groups around the country draft laws to strengthen local rights to environmental safety. For the other side of the aerial pesticide ban, I spoke today with the director of the Coalition to Defeat 21-177, Alan Fugition, who manages a third-generation family farm with his wife in Siletz, Oregon. Briefly, can you tell me a little bit about the coalition that is opposing Measure 21-177? Is it people who have worked together towards this sort of purpose before, or did you kind of come together over this measure?
Sure, yeah. Well, the Lincoln County ballot measure 21-177, I think it's titled Freedom from Aerial Sprayed Pesticides of Lincoln County, is going to appear on Lincoln County ballots in May. Ostensibly, it would ban aerial application of pesticides, which is a tool that local farmers and foresters and other land managers use to protect growing crops and protect our lands from pests and invasive species. So the coalition came together last year when we first saw a draft of this proposed ballot measure being circulated as a petition. And we had quite a bit of early support from local landowners and businesses, mostly in farming and forestry. But we also, when we started looking at the language of the ballot measure, we realized that this was going to have a much broader impact. So our coalition today includes individuals from the fishing industry. We have some banks, economic development groups, some local retailers. And from each of their diverse perspectives, I think these folks realized right away and early that this would be damaging to our county and our local communities.
You said it would have more broader effects than what you originally thought. What effects are those?
Right. So, the title itself, mentions aerial spraying, and that's kind of a narrow area of pesticide application. It's one of the tools we use. It's not the only tool. But when we read the full text of the measure, there's a lot of things in that language that are unclear to us. Ostensibly, it would ban aerial spraying, but it's a little bit ambiguously worded. So terms like aerial, corporation, direct action, they lend themselves to some uncertain legal and practical interpretations that we anticipate. So, for instance, aerial spraying could include any method that allows spray particles to move through the air, including ground-powered and hand-powered sprayer technology. So we wouldn't just be talking about helicopters and airplanes. Corporations, I think perhaps the authors of the measure, were trying to focus on sort of out of non-local corporations and big companies. But as defined in the measure, it could include all business entities, including including our farm, governments, government agencies, tribal entities. So this would make anyone who has a business or manages private or public lands or right-of-ways a corporation for the purposes of pesticide application.
I've covered a few of these, I guess not exactly similar measures, but sort of similar dynamic measures. The GMO ban in Jackson County and Josephine County, or the attempts to do that. The GMO labeling bill in Benton County, and then Oregon at large. And one thing that we always see when that happens is vast amounts of out-of-state money. And I haven't seen that happen with either side of this measure yet, but I was curious, have you heard anything from Monsanto, Dow, Syngenta? Do you expect any donations from them?
You know, we haven't really been contacted at all from the Monsantos or the Cargills or the Dow corporations of the world. Mm-hmm. But I'm pleased to say that our coalition thus far has raised over $30,000, and many of those contributions are from local businesses and individuals. We've received a lot of generous support and endorsements from like the Lincoln County Farm Bureau, the Lincoln County Small Woodlands Association, Oregon Women for Agriculture, and county farm bureaus from across the state. And I think they realize what's at stake here in Lincoln County, and we appreciate their support. When you talk about out-of-state funding, and one of the things that we took note of when we first viewed this ballot measure back in 2016 was that the group that had authored it was associated with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which is an environmental group that works nationally, I believe. And so, we realized that this was quite a bit larger than us, and that we might need to ask for help. I'm pleased that the local support has been so productive thus far to raise that much money.
All right. Well, Alan Fajishian, did I pronounce that correctly?
Correct. Yeah, well done.
Great. I'm glad. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Sure, Sam. You're very welcome. Thank you.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman, speaking with Alan Fajishian of Gibson Farms in Siletz, Oregon. He is a member of the Coalition Against Measure 21177, which seeks to ban aerial pesticide spraying in Lincoln County.
Portland area home prices continued to skyrocket last year. New data from the Case-Shiller Housing Price Index found Portland housing prices grew by more than 10% in 2016, second only behind Seattle, where prices grew by 10.8%. The median home price in Portland is now $410,000. When a 10% down payment, a home buyer would still need to earn close to $80,000 in yearly income for the house to be deemed affordable. Nationwide average home prices, when correlated to income, are now at the 2007 housing bubble peak that was reached shortly before the economic crash of 2008.
Newly released emails from the Oregon Zoo show the zoo faced internal dissent from elephant handlers and coached employees on talking points to present to the public prior to euthanizing Packy the elephant last month. Packy was the third elephant euthanized at the Oregon Zoo in the last 3 years. Rama the elephant was euthanized in March of 2015, and Tusco the elephant was euthanized in December of that year. All three had been stricken with multiple physical ailments and diseases, including tuberculosis. Packy was born in the Oregon Zoo in 1962 and lived for much of that time isolated in a small, cramped enclosure. Over his 54 years, Packy was subjected to the use of bullhooks, a practice deemed by many animal rights experts to be torture. In 2016, the animal rights organization In Defense of Animals named the Oregon Zoo the fifth worst zoo in North America for elephants, which was the seventh straight year that Oregon Zoo made the list.
U.S. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6, Radio of the Working Class, by the Working Class, and for the Working Class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, rain. Low around 48, chance of precipitation, as you guessed it, 100%. Tomorrow, rain. High near 57, chance of precipitation is 90%. Today in history, in 1968 at the Dugway Proving Ground in Utah, the U.S. Army released nearly 3,000 pounds of VX nerve agent in a chemical weapons test. Winds carried this deadly nerve agent for more than 25 miles, killing 6,000 sheep and poisoning at least one family. And in 1979, members of the National Liberation Army, the armed wing of the New Jewel Movement, attacked the Grenada Defense Force barracks at True Blue and began the Grenada Revolution. The quote for today comes from the journalist and humorist Finley Peter Dunne, who said, "It is the duty of a newspaper to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Americans for Tax Fairness say the Republican plan to kill the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, will deliver billions of dollars in tax breaks to corporations and the wealthy while adding taxes to working families. Americans for Tax Fairness is a coalition of groups, including the AFL-CIO and SEIU. House Republicans want to tax workers' health care benefits, a huge $200 billion new tax on middle-class workers. At the same time, according to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, the total tax breaks for corporations and the rich would be $594 billion over 10 years. When you go into the hospital, if there aren't enough nurses to safely care for all the patients, you have a greater chance of dying. And yet California is the only state in the U.S. with a safe nurse-patient ratio law, thanks to a long effort by the National Nurses United Nurses Union. A 2016 European study of 243 hospitals across Europe found that the more professional nurses on the job, the lower the patient death rates were. Deanne McEwen is an RN and a health and safety specialist with National Nurses United.
This looked at the existing model of care and then just the proportion of RNs to a given group of patients. And cutting the number of RNs, the risk of death can go up very high.
McEwen says nurses in Ohio got a bill introduced there in February to pass a nurse safe staffing ratio law.
Well, we just recently introduced legislation in Ohio, February 14th, Have a Heart for Nurses. And nurses are the heart of patient care. And Senator Michael Scandell there of the Ohio introduced the Ohio Patient Protection Act. So the nurses in Ohio and the public good government groups are certainly have read the data, and they want the same protection that we've won here in California.
The New Jersey State Senate is expected to vote Monday on legislation that would let police and firefighter unions manage their own pension systems. Legislation doing that was approved by a state Senate committee on a 10-to-1 vote. Police and fire unions in New Jersey may try managing their pension systems on their own. Policemen's Benevolent Association President Patrick Culligan says that police can't count on the state of New Jersey to properly care for the pensions anymore. New Jersey has systematically underfunded public employee pensions by not making adequate payments into that system for years.
Sponsored by Iron Workers Impact, now reserving spots for this year's groundbreaking conference, welcoming contractors to grow their business by networking and attending world-class breakouts. More on this event in San Diego, happening March 19th through the 22nd, is found online at impact-net.org under Events.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
On Friday, a California judge finalized a ruling that the state of California can require Monsanto to label its pesticide Roundup as a carcinogen. The judge had issued a tentative decision in late January. The ruling allows the state of California to require all products containing glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup, and many other pesticides to be labeled as a chemical, quote, known to the state to cause cancer, end quote. The ruling is a result of a lawsuit Monsanto filed against the state of California in January of 2016, when the state's EPA announced its intention to list glyphosate as a known cancer-causing chemical. Last year, the World Health Organization also deemed glyphosate to be a probable cancer-causing chemical. Experts also believe glyphosate to be a prime culprit in honeybee colony collapse syndrome.
Trump's executive orders on immigration have forced many families with foreign-born members to make emergency contingency plans. Children that are U.S. citizens but whose parents are undocumented immigrants fare a routine traffic stop can result in the separation of their families. Immigrant parents are preparing paperwork for friends, relatives, or even teachers to take custody of their kids in the event of summary deportations, euphemistically known as expedited removals. Canada is experiencing a never-before-seen wave of asylum seekers entering from the U.S. who are concerned the Trump administration will deny their petitions and deport them back to the countries they've fled. In Los Angeles, the city with the largest immigrant population in the country, Donald Trump's aggressive stance on immigration has set off widespread fear and confusion. Activists nationwide have mobilized to fight back against Trump reforms they say are racist and unconstitutional, and to inform immigrant communities about what exactly has changed and what hasn't. Students at one largely immigrant charter school in Los Angeles have joined the struggle. Carla Green with Free Speech Radio News has more.
In a high school classroom one Friday after school, a half dozen students sit quietly watching a video. This video. Four students are on screen, reading lines off sheets of paper. They're rehearsing. One of the students asks the other for her passport. It's downstairs, she says, where my children are sleeping. Please, she goes on, we don't have anything. That's a nice story, the other student replies, but stories are for the judge, not me. Let's go. Wake up the kids. ESL teacher Sarai Vasquez pauses the video.
Entonces, ¿qué opinamos? So let's start with the positives.
The students, on screen and in the classroom, are part of a new group called Colores Unidos, formed at a charter school near downtown Los Angeles.
They were created in response to Donald Trump's election.
This is Germán Gallardo, an economics teacher at the school.
So the first day after that election, a big chunk of our students, about 70% of them, walked out and protested that. And there was a lot of fear and confusion. So out of that fear and confusion, a few of those students started trying to organize and create something that would be able to bring information and a little bit of calmness to the community.
One of the students who walked out that day was Christian.
I was in chemistry class.
Since then, Christian has become the de facto leader of Colores Unidos. And he knows from personal experience why undocumented immigrants might need the Know Your Rights skits they're rehearsing. Christian is a DACA recipient. He was brought to the United States from Mexico by his parents when he was 2.5. He remembers finding out he was undocumented in elementary school. He had to fill out a permission slip to go on a camping trip, and he asked his parents for their insurance information.
That's when they told me the news about like how I'm undocumented, so I don't have some of the same rights as people, as other citizens that are born here. And since then, I've been really aware of it, and I've been called stereotypes. I've been told certain things.
Because of DACA, Christian has temporary legal status, something many recipients refer to as being DACA-mented. But he says he's nervous about the renewal process. He hasn't put in the application yet.
I'm just worried that if I go and renew my DACA, it's going to be more of a target for ICE.
Sarai Vasquez says Christian is far from the only student at the school with immigration concerns. There was a Colores Unidos meeting a couple weeks ago that a number of the students missed because there was a report that immigration agents were checking papers on a nearby street.
A lot of our students who are in the club didn't stay today. And they didn't stay today because they went home to take care of their parents, to go find out, you know, where their siblings were, where their uncles were, where their, you know, their family members were.
And Gallardo says the school has been trying to help students come up with contingency plans in case their parents get deported.
So there's been talk about us opening our doors a little later and having our students here in case there's something going on, and also going as far as identifying places in the area that will provide services that we can't. So provide free meals. There's a couple of autonomous organizations that do that in the area, so telling people that those are there.
And what is it like to have to talk to your students about that kind of thing? Like, what's that like for you as a teacher?
It's hard. We're expecting them to come in and learn whatever it is we're teaching, in my case, something about the economy. But their real pressing need is, what happens if my mom's not home? Where should we go? And if we don't have any food, where do we go? Where do we have help? It weighs on them.
Gallardo is proud of his students for organizing themselves in response to Trump's policies. But he also thinks it's important to put Trump's stance on immigration and deportation in context.
What has changed is that the rhetoric is now out in the open. I remember raids in the 80s. I remember friends whose parents were taken out of work and tossed into somewhere. I remember every single economic downturn, and people who are immigrants are always the scapegoats. So that isn't new. So when we talk about things that have changed, it's changed because now liberal, middle-class, white folks have to deal with the reality.
Back in the classroom, the Colores Unidos group is rating the acting performance of their peers.
The two girls in the middle were very, like, projecting their voice, and they were speaking really well. But I think the girl on that,
Sara Vasquez suggests the students at the meeting come to the actors' next rehearsal. The actors are mostly freshmen, and the students at the meeting are upperclassmen. You could really help them out, Vasquez says. The upperclassmen nod, wisely. The actors will continue to rehearse during lunchtime and after school to prepare for their next performance, playing ICE agents and terrified immigrants. But some of them will do it with the knowledge that their own family's lives could be upended at any moment, and the skits could become frighteningly real. Carla Green for FSRN in Los Angeles.
The Congressional Budget Office reported today the number of Americans without health insurance will skyrocket if the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, is replaced with a proposed Republican alternative. According to the CBO, 14 million more people would be uninsured under the GOP's proposal than under current law. The number of uninsured would jump dramatically over the next decade. An estimated 52 million people will be without health insurance by 2026 because of the repeal of the ACA, compared with only 28 million who would lack insurance that year if the ACA remains in effect. The CBO and the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation also estimate that under the GOP's proposal, average premiums for single policyholders in the non-group market would be 15 to 20% higher than under current law.
Two Native tribes have asked a U.S. District Court judge for an injunction on the Dakota Access Pipeline while awaiting an appeal of the judge's decision to allow construction on the pipeline to be completed. Last week, U.S. District Judge James Boasberg refused the request of the Standing Rock and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes to stop construction on the final segment of the Dakota Pipeline. Energy Transfer Partners, the company behind the Dakota Pipeline, expects to have oil moving through its newly constructed pipeline as early as this week. An attorney for the tribes filed an appeal last Friday, citing concerns over a possible oil spillage into Lake Oahe, and asked the judge to halt construction until the appeal is heard. Energy Transfer Partners and the Army Corps of Engineers have until tomorrow to file their response to the appeal. Meanwhile, as reported on the KBOO Evening News last Tuesday, a 232-mile-long pipeline has been proposed to run through southern Oregon from Coos Bay to the California border with the purpose of shipping natural gas abroad to Asian markets. Two separate groups, one in favor of the proposed pipeline and one opposing it, had booked meetings at the same Ramada Inn in Medford, Oregon, from March 23rd to agitate over the matter. Apparently fearing controversy, the Ramada Inn in Medford has canceled both meetings so far without public comment. A hearing on the proposed Oregon pipeline was reportedly scheduled to take place in Klamath Falls on Friday, March 24th, according to an article in the Klamath Falls Herald and News, but the article appears to have been taken down from the paper's website.
So far this month, the Trump administration has announced major changes to current energy and environmental standards. Speaking on national television last week, the new chief of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, claimed that human activity is not a primary contributor to global warming and announced plans to cut the EPA by 24%. Also slated for the chopping block is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency, with its National Satellite Data and Information Services Office facing the largest cuts. That office operates the satellites, radars, buoys, and weather stations used to measure global sea and air temperatures. Pruitt also announced that oil and gas companies are no longer required to measure methane emissions from oil drilling and fracking operations.
And now it's time for This Week in Water from H2O Radio.
Trump tees up another conflict. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
It was a stunning statement, even to those who suspected something like it was probably coming.
Last week, the new head of the EPA, Scott Pruitt, said he would not agree that carbon dioxide is a primary contributor to global warming, adding that we don't know yet what role CO2 plays.
But we do know what CO2 does to the atmosphere, and Pruitt is dead wrong, at least according to the vast majority of scientists. The idea that there is uncertainty about the greenhouse gas is contrived or made up, according to Quartz, an online news outlet.
4 years ago, 2,000 international scientists found that the warming that occurred from 1951 to 2010 was extremely likely to be a consequence of human emissions of CO2 along with other greenhouse gases.
Stephen Pakala of Princeton University told PolitiFact that Pruitt's statement means he does not accept the overwhelming scientific consensus.
And his views even contradict some people in the fossil fuel industry.
An executive vice president for Shell Energy said last week at a conference of energy producers that he was absolutely convinced CO2 can cause serious damage not only to this generation, but to future generations.
Pruitt hasn't responded to requests to clarify his comments, but earlier he said that the future of the EPA ain't what it used to be, according to the New York Times.
Last week, Mustafa Ali, head of the EPA's Environmental Justice Program, resigned after it was learned the Trump administration planned to cut his office entirely.
That office at the EPA was established by President Bill Clinton after activists identified a pattern of locating polluting industries in poor communities of color.
In contrast to Pruitt, large oil companies are beginning to see the downside of fossil fuels.
Royal Dutch Shell is not only talking about the negative effects of CO2 emissions, they're starting to invest in renewable energy.
The company announced that by the end of this decade, it will spend $1 billion on renewables. While this amount is not that large relative to Shell's budget, it's still significant.
The chair of the company said the biggest challenge Shell faces is eroding public trust in their industry.
In January, Saudi Aramco, the world's largest oil company, said that it was considering a $5 billion investment in renewables. Golfing is important to Donald Trump.
Golf Digest, one of the leading publications for the sport, called him the golfer-in-chief.
So it's likely he was paying attention in 2015 when the Obama administration announced a new rule that could lead to regulation of relatively small bodies of water.
Farmers and real estate developers attacked the new regulation, saying it was an overreach by government and a power grab.
And so did the associated golf course superintendents, who feared that ponds, lakes, and streams on their grounds would be subject to the Clean Water Act.
But now the new president has ordered the rule to be rescinded and rewritten, calling it one of the worst examples of federal regulation.
In doing so, he has teed up the issue of his conflicts of interest.
There are 17,000 members of the superintendent's group, and the head lobbyist for the organization told Bloomberg that they're pleased to see an effort by the Trump administration to revisit the rule.
That golfing group, which includes more than 20 Trump employees, spent $30,000 lobbying against the regulation when it was announced.
On average, each golf course in the U.S. has 11 acres of water bodies like lakes, ponds, and streams. The golfing industry feared increased costs if they had to keep those waters clean, according to EPA standards.
Trump has not divested himself of his business holdings, which include 12 courses in the U.S.
New research shows that droughts may travel across continents in patterns that scientists can predict.
The study published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters shows that about 10% of droughts travel between about 900 to 2,000 miles, and these tend to be the largest and most severe.
Julio Herrera Estrada of Princeton University, who led the study, told Climate News Network that some intense droughts migrate like a slow-motion hurricane on a time scale of months to years instead of days to weeks.
The importance of this work is that water managers might be able to cope with drought much better if they know where and when shortages could occur.
The next step for researchers is to study the reasons droughts travel and to understand their behavior.
The study comes as 20 million people in Africa and the Middle East are facing famine due in part to drought.
And finally, an ideal vacation would include a hotel that lets you drift off to sleep in a beautiful place, right?
Well, a Japanese theme park has got you covered by taking the word drift literally. It's launching floating sleeping pods at its island-based attraction.
The hotel's rooms are futuristic-looking orbs that can sleep up to four people with beds, toilets, showers, plus a perfect view of the stars.
Guests bob across the sea overnight and arrive at an island which has numerous attractions that tourists can explore the following day.
In theory, anyway, it has yet to be revealed exactly how the floating spheres move across the water or if they'll be monitored.
For that reason, people are divided on its appeal. One commenter told Neighbors Matome News, "Imagine waking up in the morning and finding yourself in North Korea."
This isn't the first time the company has pushed the envelope in accommodations. In 2015, the park opened the Hanana Hotel, the world's first to be staffed by robots. At their front desk, a female humanoid appears to breathe, blink, and for extra creeps, seems to make eye contact as she greets you and answers questions about your stay.
The floating pods aren't due to open until the end of the year, but if you do go, you might want to bring some snacks. It doesn't appear there will be room service of any kind, and if you did call the front desk, you might get this.
"I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that."
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Build a better world through better water at AWWA's ACE 17 in Philadelphia, June 11th through 14th. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE17.
The Scottish government today announced plans to hold another referendum on independence from the United Kingdom. The vote is expected to take place sometime in late 2018 or early 2019. A vote on Scottish independence was defeated in 2014 prior to the narrow approval by UK voters of a referendum on leaving the European Union. Voters in Scotland overwhelmingly opposed the so-called Brexit. This decision by Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon follows a vote in the UK House of Commons to allow plans for Brexit to move forward. The Brexit bill passed the House of Commons in early February, and the House of Lords amended the proposal and sent it back to the lower chamber last week. MPs took out the Lords' amendments and are returning the bill to the Lords, where it appears likely to pass. Under the new bill, Parliament may not get a vote on the final Brexit deal that the UK government will negotiate with the European Union. Brexit negotiations are currently expected to conclude in late 2018, with the UK withdrawing from the European Union by March 2019.
Japan has announced plans to sail its largest warship through the contested South China Sea. An aircraft carrier and accompanying battleships will be the largest show of force by Japan outside of Japanese waters since the end of World War II. The warship will rendezvous with the U.S. Navy and engage in war games before returning to Japan in late August. The area for the Japanese-American war games in the South China Sea has been claimed by the Chinese government as Chinese territory. The U.S. and its allies say the area is in international waters, and the war games are meant to emphasize that fact.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zer, Tawny LaTigra, Sam Bowman, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News at H2O Radio. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News Director is Zelos Marchant, and the Evening Public Affairs Director is Kanan Schlesinger. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Zelos Marchant.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show welcomes PSU Professor of History David A. Horowitz to the KBOO studio. At 9, an alternative radio, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, presents a way to combat inequality with an indigenous economic model. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on stage and studio, Eastern Oregon author Bing Bingham talks about his book, Shaped by the Land, Stories of the Rural American West. Then a preview of the new documentary, Never Give Up, about Oregon civil rights leader Minoru Yasui. And at 11:30, Art Focus features interviews with curators, writers, and artists. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Sal.
Good night. Good night, Daniel.
The annual meeting of the United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs opened today in Vienna, Austria. A growing number of nations are criticizing the dominant international drug control paradigm, which is based on prohibition of some drugs, and are calling for a wide range of reforms. Several nations in this hemisphere, including Mexico, Guatemala, Uruguay, Bolivia, and Colombia, are leading the reform effort. They argue that over-reliance on law enforcement and criminal justice strategies has backfired, and that nations need to put more emphasis on prevention and treatment alternatives. Here's Miguel Ruiz Cabañas, Undersecretary for Multilateral Affairs and Human Rights at the Secretariat of Foreign Affairs of Mexico. This audio is courtesy of the United Nations, which also provides simultaneous interpretation into English.
In April 2016, at the special session, the President of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, affirmed that the system based essentially on prohibition, the so-called war against drugs, which started in the 1970s, has not managed to reduce production, trafficking, or consumption of drugs in the world. Almost 1 year later, we are saying here that we still believe that this commission should accept the new paradigm shift agreed in UNGAS 2016 and provide a more realistic approach to the principle of common and shared responsibility and international cooperation, a focus on people, which acknowledges that the world drug problem should be tackled from a public health point of view, from that of prevention, human rights, justice, and sustainable development. We cannot do anything except acknowledge the role of transnational organized crime here. And we cannot respond to new expressions of the problem with the same decades-old vision and pretend that we will get better results when, despite all our efforts, the world consumption of drugs has not fallen and the age at which people begin is now younger. Organized crime has increased its earnings and extended its activities to money laundering, weapons trafficking, extortion, and people trafficking. Illicit crops of cannabis, poppies, and coca have spread all over the world. A growing number of local, state, and national governments have approved legislation to regulate the use of cannabis for medical and scientific purposes, and in some cases for recreational purposes, whilst others have done so de facto. Moreover, hundreds of new psychoactive substances are circulating without control, causing more damaging effects on health than those drugs for which the international control system was designed. As was agreed at UNGAS, we should strengthen those measures which have worked and call on flexibility of the international conventions to change those which have not produced results. Madam Chair, the outcome document of UNGAS 2016 represents the most advanced multilateral consensus in the field of drugs policy and updates the terms of the international debate towards the review of the 2019 Plan of Action. Mexico, therefore, welcomes the UN's efforts to support countries in the implementation of national level. The government of Mexico has organized a series of thematic debates based on the seven areas of the UNGAS document to review international experiences, alternative trends, and lessons learned, accompanied by a regional body, the Inter-American Commission Against Drug Abuse of the Organization of American States. So we want to include all subjects and all relevant stakeholders, and therefore we have promoted a plural dialogue, one which is action-based with the participation of governmental experts, representatives of civil society, international organizations, and other relevant sectors, as well as legislators. With the evidence we have seen in these debates, it is now clear that the prohibition approach based on penalties will never be enough. We have learned, what is more, that the effectiveness of drug policies should be measured by the impact they have on people's lives, on social inclusion, and possibilities of achieving sustainable development. The World Drug Strategy cannot ignore the new way of working within the United Nations in favor of sustainable development, breaking with thematic competencies to generate intersectoral multidimensional strategies. We therefore recognize that in the most recent drugs report of UNODC has included the opportunity to align the efforts of the CND with the Agenda 2030. We also see that in the annual report of the INCB,